Our Old Testament lesson today comes from 1 Samuel chapter 16, verses 1 through 23. The Lord said to Samuel, "How long are you going to grieve over Saul? I have rejected him as king over Israel. Fill your horn with oil and get going. I am sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem because I have found my next king among his sons." "How can I do that?" Samuel asked. "When Saul hears of it, he'll kill me." "Take a heifer with you," the Lord replied, "and say, 'I have come to make a sacrifice to the Lord.' Invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will make clear to you what you should do. You will anoint for me the person I point out to you." Samuel did what the Lord instructed. When he came to Bethlehem, the city elders came to meet him. They were shaking with fear. "Do you come in peace?" they asked. "Yes," Samuel answered. "I've come to make a sacrifice to the Lord. Now make yourselves holy. Then come with me to the sacrifice." Samuel made Jesse and his sons holy and invited them to the sacrifice as well. When they arrived, Samuel looked at Eliab and thought, "That must be the Lord's anointed right in front." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Have no regard for his appearance or stature, because I haven't selected him." God doesn't look at things the way humans do. Humans see only what is visible to the eyes, but the Lord sees into the heart. Next, Jesse called Abinadab, who presented himself to Samuel, but he said, "The Lord hasn't chosen this one either." So Jesse presented Shema, but Samuel said, "No, the Lord hasn't chosen this one." Jesse picked 7 of his sons to Samuel. But Samuel said to Jesse, "The Lord hasn't picked any of these." Then Samuel asked Jesse, "Is that all of your boys?" "There is still the youngest one," Jesse answered, "but he is out keeping the sheep." "Send for him," Samuel told Jesse, "because we can't proceed until he gets here." So Jesse sent and brought him in. He was reddish brown, had beautiful eyes, and was good looking. The Lord said, "That's the one. Go anoint him." So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him right there in front of his brothers. The Lord's Spirit came over David from that point forward.
So we come this morning to look at David's life, particularly as this boy, as Angela said, between 8 and 12 to 15 years old, somewhere in that range. And we're going through these weeks as we're in this back to school season, really exploring what we can learn from children in Scripture. We've looked at Moses as an infant and how the women around him risked everything to care for him and for others that were at risk, even putting their own lives in danger. We looked last week at Samuel and learning to listen and discern the voice of God, even in the midst of the church, sometimes when it's so easy to take God's presence for granted, we don't even recognize when God is speaking to us. And then all the way back to school Sunday, we saw over in the fellowship hall the way Jesus invited the children and set them up as a model and an example for all of us to become like them in our sense of awe and wonder and dreaming and asking questions and a kingdom imagination to do God-sized things and to step out in faith as a child might. And so we've seen all of this and recognized children throughout Scripture. Next week, we're going to actually, even though we'll be in a new series, going to turn to one last child, and that is Jeremiah, who was also called like David as a young boy. And we'll spend several weeks looking at his whole life and his ministry as a prophet of God. But today, specifically looking at David as a boy, and what's really interesting about this passage is that at this point, we don't really know anything at all about David's qualifications to be called as a king, to be used by God in any way, shape, or form, other than the fact that he takes care of sheep. He's a kid that works in the field, okay, so he's good at doing his chores. That's not necessarily the first qualification we want to look at for king. And so when we think about David and we look back at his life, this isn't the passage we usually go to. What's the first thing usually if I were to say, let's talk about David, what would be the first thing that would come up for you all?
Goliath,
there we go, there's a big one. Now see, now that's something that's worthy of making David king, right? He defeats the giant, he kills the enemy, he's victorious. What else? Any other stories about David that pop up? Any other stories at all? There's a million of them to choose from. Bathsheba, all right. See, now there's the reason we were not so sure we want David to be king anymore. He has some failings, right? He has some moral failings. He takes the wife of another man and then has her husband killed to cover up the whole ordeal. Can't we just imagine this whole life, like in modern day political terms? Like, imagine him campaigning later on in his life for his position as king. On one hand, we've got the people shouting and cheering, David killed Goliath, when all of the people in Saul's party, well, they were too weak. They were scared. They wouldn't fight for your country. They just cowered and hid from this champion of the Philistines. And David stood up and took him out with a single stone. He had five, but he didn't even need five. He just did it with one stone. He's so great. And we elevate David as the one we read about over and over and over again in the scriptures when the people chant, Saul killed his thousands, but David killed his 10,000s. He's a great military hero. These are wonderful campaign sort of slogans and the things that we would see on ads, but then the opposition would come in. And they wouldn't say anything good about themselves, because why would we actually say anything positive about ourselves when it's so much easier to tear down the opponent? And we've got dirt on David. We've got that time when he cheated with Bathsheba. We've got that time when he abused his power and took another man's wife and had him killed out in the field. Everybody says he's a military hero, but he turned against his own army, his own general, and betrayed his friends. Do we really want a leader like this, a man after God's own heart? Indeed. And when we look back at David's life from the end, and we see these times when David showed great strength, when David showed great restraint and mercy, even when Saul was after him trying to kill him, and twice David forgave and showed mercy and chose not to take revenge. We see all of these great characteristics in David's life. We see Israel coming to its height as a nation under David's reign, and we think this is a good king. But then we also have those times when we look back and think, man, he messed up. This man is nothing like God. He is not a good model or a good example for the people of God. And I think oftentimes we have that same problem when we look back at our own lives. If we were to sit right now and take time to examine our lives and we ask the question, am I worthy of God's call on my life? Am I worthy of God's love? Have I lived up to the high and holy calling that God has brought me into as a Christian, as a witness of his love to the world? And we look back at our lives, and we might be like David in some ways. We might look back and we have a highlight reel. Nowadays, it's pretty easy to see our highlight reel because it's all on social media. We might have to look back before those days, and we have to dig in a little deeper to figure out what the highlights are. But we all remember the highlights of our lives, the great things we did, or maybe at least members of our family might remember the great things we did. Sometimes it's harder for us to see the good in ourselves. And we look back at the times that we've shown love. We look back at the sacrifices we made for our children and our grandchildren. We look back at all the ways we've served our church through the years, or the ways we were a good employee at work, the ways we were a good citizen, maybe our service to our country. And we think of all these times when we were faithful to God and say, yeah, I I've done okay. I've done pretty good. I've lived a pretty good, faithful life. And then there are other times where we think, yeah, but I hope God doesn't bring up that one time or that one situation. Or maybe we try to pretend that those things didn't happen and somebody else in our lives brings it up, because it's somebody that was unable to forgive us. Or there's somebody in our life that we're unable to forgive, and they think that they've done pretty good, and they're at the end of their lives, and we're like, seriously? You think you did pretty good? Do you realize what you did to me? Do you realize what you did to my family? Do you realize what you did to your friends. We're always good at bringing those things up about other people. And other people can probably bring those things up about us, those times when we even unintentionally caused great harm. And so when we look at our lives, it's really hard to evaluate our worth before God. And I think the same is true for David. And I think that's why it's so interesting and so poignant that David is called as such a young boy. Because when God looks at David and God says, "This is the man to lead my people," God doesn't look at David and say, "This is the man who killed tens of thousands. This is the man who can stand up against a giant. This is the man who will show mercy even when he is threatened." He also doesn't look at a man who says, "Yeah, he's not going to make it. He's not going to be able to take the pressure when things get too easy or too difficult in life. He's going to give in to temptation. He's going to do great harm. And so, no, I don't really want him in this position." Neither David's successes and achievements, nor his greatest failures, play in to God's call on his life. And I think that's the beauty of learning from the children in Scripture and learning how God's heart towards children is so open and how God is calling each and every one of us. Because when he looks at our lives, God doesn't look at us through the lens of all of our accomplishments and achievements. And he doesn't look at us through the lens of all of our failures and mistakes. He simply looks at us as he looked at David and said, "This one's mine. I love him. I love her. No matter what he or she will do, no matter what he or she has done, they are my child. They're my little boy. They're my little girl. They're my beloved." And David was called from that place. And I wonder if David could look back from the end of his life, having plenty of regrets and also plenty of things to be proud of, just as all of us do. But instead of evaluating, was there enough good to outweigh the bad, could he really come back to that place where he was in the field, when he was singing out the praises of God, like we read in Psalm 8, "Oh Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth." He probably didn't have that tune. That was written in the 80s, I think. But same words that he penned in Psalm 8. Writing these words of praise, "Who am I, O Lord, that you would even notice me? So insignificant here out in the fields among the sheep, and yet called to be king over your people." Can he remember back and think, this is what mattered to God? That as a child, he loved God with all his heart and soul and mind and strength. And that he would give anything to serve faithfully and to worship and praise. That later on, he would go into the king's court and play the harp when the king was depressed and attacked by evil spirits. And David would play praises to the Lord, and it would calm King Saul's heart. This David, who's pure of heart, is the David that God called as a boy. And what I find really interesting is, though God would look at this boy and say, "He's mine, he's the one. I've got big things for him," even though he's not proven himself, he's never been in battle. As we see later on, he can't even fit in the king's armor to be able to go into battle. He's too little, you know, like a kid trying to put on his dad's suit. It just doesn't work. And yet, despite all this, God says, "This one's mine." And yet his own family, his own father, his own brothers, never acknowledged such a truth. Here's the thing that came up for me reading this passage again this week. Samuel came to anoint a new king. He had to do it in secret because he knew Saul would be angry, even though Saul had already been rejected by God because of his sin. And he came and he knew that the new king would be a member of the family of Jesse. And so he came as a prophet to offer sacrifice to the Lord. This was a normal practice. People even asked when he comes. We read in the passage a few minutes ago that when he came, people said, "Are you here in peace, or do we have to worry?" He said, "No, I'm just here to make the sacrifice." He's not going to say outright, no, I'm here to choose a new king and we're going to start a revolution and get you all in trouble. No. I'm just here to make a sacrifice. We're here to have a church service. We're here to have a prayer service. Nothing wrong with that. And we invite everybody to the prayer service, and Jesse brings all of his sons as he would, except David. And here's what I thought. How ironic that the one God would choose to lead his people is the one that his own father didn't even deem worthy enough to bring to worship. He's too young. He might cry in the service and disrupt everybody. He might stir up trouble or go out playing in the mud and get his dress clothes dirty. He's just not old enough to really understand the hymns and the rituals and everything that's happening, so we'll just leave him out in the field. Somebody's got to do the chores. Somebody's got to take care of the sheep. The one who was most worthy to God was not even worthy enough to his own dad to come to church. And what does that say to us about how we respond to kids and teenagers in our churches and in our communities? When we gripe and complain, they're not here, where are they? They don't come to church. And yet, when they do, how many times have we seen them ignored? How many times have we seen them shoved off in another room somewhere because they make too much mess, or they make too much noise, or they do music that we don't like, or whatever other reasons we have for not wanting them to really be here in our midst? I remember sitting with a couple of confirmation students at a previous church that I was at. It was a week that only two of them came. And so instead of having class, we just sat out on the porch of the church during that hour before the service and just talked, getting to know them a little bit. And the one girl in particular, not long after that confirmation class, would end up leaving, not because she wanted to, but because her mom ended up in jail. And she tried to go live with her sister, who was 20, for a little while, and the state wouldn't allow it. And so she ended up having to move across the state somewhere to her aunt's that she didn't like at all. And made a very difficult situation for her in her life. But, you know, we're sitting there talking, and what I found interesting about this girl, she didn't come to church very often, but she was coming to confirmation with her friend. And she was so happy to see people. She was so isolated in her home and so cut off because of the bad situation that she was in with her family. And so when she was out at church, she dressed dark, you know, black hair and, you know, kind of the kind of person that you would think, oh, well, you know, she's just kind of to herself kind of thing. But she always had a smile when people came by and people would walk up the steps heading into worship. And she was the one who would say hi to every single one of them. And I sat there for an hour with these two girls, and every time as we were talking, I watched her say hi to every single church member that walked through the door. And I could count on less than one hand the number of those who acknowledged her existence. People that saw her in church every week during the confirmation time, not so much during other times, but people that would walk up the stairs, kind of give a nod to me, and act as if these two teenagers weren't even there. They're not worthy enough to be spoken to. They're young. They're insignificant. They're not faithful members in the church. Their parents aren't tithing members. Their parents don't even bring them most of the time. Well, one of their parents is almost in jail, so give her a break. But we look on the outside, and we think somehow they're less worthy. I started out in ministry as a youth pastor, and I found the same kind of scenario over and over and over again. Kids that were lucky to be able to get there on a Wednesday night, and that was their church, and they were only able to get there because they were able to ride with a friend. And then oftentimes I would give them a ride home. Two girls in particular, twins, sixth grade. They never knew which house they were going to go to after school because their mom stayed with a different boyfriend every night. So they didn't even know where they were going. And they were able to get a ride with a friend to church sometimes. And I remember getting a lecture from the council as the youth pastor of this church why aren't those kids here serving at our dinners? Why aren't they in church on Sunday mornings? You're not doing your job. You're not getting them to be part of the church. Like, they're lucky to have anybody in their lives that spends any time at all listening to them. They even asked me in the car driving them back to their mom's one day. They said, if you had kids, would you ever talk to them? I didn't know how to respond. I didn't have kids at the time, but I was just shocked at the question. I was only 22, 23. I was stunned, and they said, I don't remember the last time our mom talked to us. And we never knew our dad. And all the church leaders could do was complain that they weren't here on Sunday mornings and they weren't serving at the dinners. And I think of David out in the fields. He's doing his job as a kid. He's seen and not heard. He's doing his chores. He's serving. He's picking up after the sheep. He's making sure that all the tasks are done. He's being the good, obedient child. But there's no place for him in worship. There's no place for him in God's house. There's no place for him to be able to ask the hard questions. There's no place for him to come and watch Samuel make the sacrifice and be able to say, hey, preacher dude, why are you killing that sheep? Help me understand. What does all this mean? There's nobody to answer his questions about who God is. Because he's too busy doing the good kid thing out by himself somewhere where nobody has to see him until he's old enough. And then when he gets old enough, you know, in our culture, 18, now all of a sudden they're off to college and they're getting jobs somewhere else. And what do we do in the church? Why'd they all leave the church? Why'd they all abandon us? All those years we said, you are our future. We want you here because you're our future. We want to make sure that you're going to be here faithfully when we're gone. And now you disappear and you go off to some other community and you build families and have jobs in the city. And you're gone. And how did you betray our church? And how many of them ask, what church? I was never part of your church. I was in a nursery in some back room. I was somewhere where I wasn't allowed to say anything. I wasn't allowed to be seen. Everybody walked past me on the stairs and nobody ever spoke to me. I wasn't included in your worship, and now you want me to be there to make sure your church has a future? And it breaks my heart when I think about how many kids, like David, never have a place. And yet God, like David, is speaking to them and saying, I'm calling you. And you may never stand in the pulpit of one of these churches that we have, but you know what? You're going to have opportunities with your friends to share my love and to share the way I had grace on you even when nobody else did. You're going to have opportunities to talk to that kid at school. And they have parents who won't talk to them, and you say, yeah, my mom doesn't talk to me either. But, you know, there's this couple over at this church, and, you know, they're the youth pastors, and they always have time to listen. Come with me and talk to them. There's always opportunities. And if you're a young person right now here, or if you're watching online, a teenager, a child, I want to say this very clearly. And that is this: you are not the future of our church. You are not the future of our country. You are the present. You are here now. And you are beloved by God, and you are gifted by God, and you are called by God, and you have opportunities in your life, in your school, in your families, even in your church, wherever you are, to serve and to be faithful and to sing the songs of praise in the field as David did. And to know God's love and to embrace that joy and to live in such a way that your faith and your joy and your dreaming and your hard questions and all the things that you're wrestling with become contagious and become part of who we are as a community here and now. And it doesn't matter what church, if any church you ever become part of or lead in the future, you are part of God's family here and now and today. And for those of us who are older, the question is, how do we make our kids and our grandkids and our nieces and nephews and our friends and our neighbors feel that way? So included, so a part of it. How is it that God doesn't have to go hunting them down and say to us, hey, you got any other grandkids? You got any other nieces and nephews? There's got to be somebody out there. Well, no, we brought all the good ones. Yeah, you wouldn't want the other one here. He just sits in his room all the time and sulks and miserable and sits on his video games. You wouldn't want him here. Or well, no, they're always, you know, out late on Friday nights. They're always sleeping on Sunday mornings. They probably just snore here in the service. You don't want them here. Bring them. Bring them. Because God is calling them. And God may even have a word for them to teach to you. To teach to us. There's a church in Kentucky led by a friend of mine called Grace Kids. Literally, the whole church is nothing but children. It was a dying church in the hood in Louisville, Kentucky. And this guy went in as a local pastor and realized that the kids were coming like crazy. And finally, he just said, we can't do it anymore. We can't be a normal church. This is a church for kids. They completely changed the name, the image, everything. They've got a Gaga ball court in the back of the sanctuary, for goodness sake. And you know what? In order to play the games, part of the deal is that they have a rule that if they get out of the game, they can get back in if they can answer a Bible question. Well, guess what? He got to the point where he was having to pull out seminary notes to come up with questions that were hard enough for these kids not to keep getting back in the game and making it go for hours because they were hungry. These kids who are on the streets, who have parents who are in broken relationships and painful situations in their lives, they're now preaching to their friends who's sitting out of the church as he does every time in the mornings before school, and the kids ride their bike to school and they always ride past the church to stop by and say hi to the preacher. He was commenting just last week how one of his kids was sad that he couldn't be there for their Friday night service. They don't come on Sunday mornings. They do Friday nights. And he said that this one kid was really sad because he had gotten grounded and he couldn't come to church. He was grounded from church. And he said, at first I was kind of caught off guard by that. How can you ground somebody from church? And then it dawned on me. For these kids, church is as much of a privilege as TV or video games or parties or anything else that they might be grounded from. That's the kind of church we want to be. That's the kind of church we want to be for our kids, for our teachers, for our parents, for the people in our community who God is calling and God is speaking to, and we don't even know it yet because all those people that God is calling are out somewhere feeding sheep or pumping gas or working behind a counter for a salary that can't even support their family or handing us food at a table at some restaurant after church. God is calling. God is calling, and God is not calling on the basis of what they've done. He's not rejecting them on the basis of their mistakes. He's simply calling them for who they are, just as he called David. You're just my boy. Just my girl. Just my child. Just my kid. And that, I think, is why Jesus said, let the children come. Let the children come. And anyone who holds one of these children back, he says, it would be better for them to have a millstone tied around their neck than thrown in the sea. Who would say such a thing? Oh, yeah, that was Jesus. That's how seriously Jesus took it, that the kids should be included. That they are not our future, that they are part of us. They are part of our families. They are part of our community. They are part of our church. And they are just God's children. And they remind us to look back over our own lives and remember all the times we were unworthy. Remember all the times we felt unwelcome. to remember all the times we felt excluded and felt like nobody cared. And to remember that through it all, whatever our lives, our ups and our downs, we are still just God's child. Just God's boy, just God's girl. With a song in the field, singing praises to the one who truly loves us like no other ever has or ever could. So the song is from a friend of ours from college, Andrew Ehrenzeller. It's called Just Your Boy. It's about David in the fields singing those songs of praise. May this be our song today. God, I'm just your kid. I'm just your boy. I'm just your girl. Remember me. And remember all those who you love. Half of lions, slain by giants, and I've been on the run. Sat with kings and I've done great things, but in the end, no, I was just a son with a song on the field. Well, it made me who I am, and it made you all so real. Those days are not gone. I was just your boy and you were just my God. Yeah, I'm just your boy, you are just my God. I was lost then, I was found, oh, I've been weak and proud and only left me all alone. Been thick as thieves and I've been deceived, but in the end, I was still a son with a song on the field. Well, it made me who I am, and it made you all so real. Those days are not gone, when I was just your boy, and you were just my God. Yeah, I'm just your boy. Just my God. On my deathbed, I will lay my head and reflect with only one request. Let me be remembered. Not as a soldier, but as your son, who sang till the end with a song. The field, well, it made me who I am, and it made you all so real. Those days are not gone, when I was just your boy, you were just my God. Yeah, I'm just your boy. Just my God, yeah, I'm just your boy, you just my God. Lord, in the end, no matter our achievements, no matter our failures, we are just your little boys and girls. Somewhere in a field, somewhere in a back room of a house, or playing in a backyard, or staring up at the stars in the sky. Somewhere where none of the adults notice that we exist. Deep in the recesses of our childhood. And we remember how you saw us then. How you loved us then, even before we even knew who you were. But we dreamed and we imagined and we longed for the kind of love that you offer. We sang songs of praise Because we knew there was something greater, there was something amazing, there was something marvelous, something wondrous, something awe-filled about the universe around us. And so we sat like David and we looked at all the wonderful world around us in awe and wonder, and we sang out, "How majestic is your name. How great and wondrous is the one who would create all of this, is the one who would breathe life into my frail body. And who am I, O Lord, that you would be mindful of me? Who am I that you would call me? All the things I'm not worthy of, all the things that nobody sees that I'm capable of, all the gifts that I have that have gone unused because I didn't even realize that I was needed or that there was a place for me. And yet you keep calling. You keep saying, go get them. Go get the ones in the fields. Go get the ones in the back rooms, in the back alleys, in the backyards, in the darkest places of our world, and bring them here. Bring them to the sacrifice. Bring them to the place of worship. Bring them to the place where they can know God's deep love and deep call on their lives, where God can use them, for better or worse, to transform the world. So, Lord, thank you for this invitation. Both as children of all ages who in some ways are still stuck in those places of feeling insignificant and isolated and cast out, and also as adults who may have done the same to others. Forgive us for the ways we have fallen short. Forgive us for the people we have overlooked in our lives and for the ways we have resented those who have overlooked us. Help us to take joy in what it means to just be your boy, to just be your girl, to just be your kid, beloved for who we are and for who you created us to be. In Jesus' precious name we pray. Amen.